Hello, my name is Richard Smith, and I'm going to be delivering this presentation via podcast because I am not able to be present at the conference. Unfortunately, my mother had surgery, and I'm down in Florida at the moment, so being with her. So hopefully some people will be able to listen to this, and so I'm going to assume that you're looking at the PowerPoint presentation. So I'm going to go through the PowerPoint slide by slide, and when I'm done with the slide, I'll try to remember to say advanced slide. So the name of my presentation is Sociomedia: The Transformative Power of Technology, and my goal is to try to talk about the possibilities that technology are bringing to us now to completely change the way we do education. And hopefully by the time you're done with this, you'll have some ideas about how to do that. So we're going to advance the slide. And this suggests that there's a difference between thinking of sociomedia versus hypermedia. Hypermedia, according to this fellow Edward Barrett, puts the emphasis on the machine rather than on the people using the machine. So he wants to create a neologism called sociomedia to suggest that computer media exists for social purposes. So his model, we're going to advance the slide, his model is that there are two components of sociomedia: engagement and construction. Engagement involves the interaction with people. Construction involves students creating a product from their collaboration. And I have a number of examples of what this model of education, or of kind of conceiving of educational uses of technology, can suggest. So if we advance a slide, we'll see the first example of sociomedia is from a teacher I taught with in biology, and her project was focused on global warming, on the Kyoto Accord. This was back in 1997-98, and she partnered with an English class in Germany, and their goal was to co-write a persuasive letter to send to their respective government legislators, representatives, and get them to vote for this accord. So they did the research behind it to find out what was involved, and they actually wrote this and actually sent the letters. And she actually won a state award for environmental education for that project. The second example I have, we'll advance a slide, is by the teacher who is now the principal of my school, Crystal Murch. And for her, in the English class, this is back in the year 2000 or so, we were invited to do a video conferencing with a class in the Netherlands, and we were the only United States country involved in this project. And the issue was the rights of the child, or the universal human rights of the United Nations. And the class was supposed to argue for which right should be the most important in the 21st century and why. They were supposed to create some kind of play or some kind of presentation and have it videotaped and then share that with the class over video conferencing. Well, unfortunately, the technology wasn't there for us at the time. We were using CUCME and didn't quite work. So, but I think it was successful in terms of pedagogy, because the kids definitely worked together, they created something, and they were ready to talk to this class in the Netherlands, and they were really, really quite into it because they knew that this was something important and something very relevant. Advance the slide. The third example of sociomedia is actually an example from my experience of teaching college English about 10, 11 years ago, and I was asking my students to create a text-based virtual reality, which was known as a MOO at the time. A MOO was a MUD that was object-oriented, not anything you need to know. But the goal was to create this for a local fifth-grade class. There was a elementary school across the street from the college. And we had read The Phantom Tollbooth, which is a great little allegory, kind of educational, about the need for mathematics and English and to be kind of united together. And I remember reading it in fifth grade and really loving it and kind of being impressed by it. The need for mathematics and English and to be kind of united together. And I remember reading it in fifth grade and really loving it and kind of being impressed by it. So they read that as a model, and then they invented a allegorical educational environment. And the class actually came over, a fifth grade class came over and went through their MOO. So, you know, they knew this was the end result and that this would happen. So they had a real audience for that. And they were, it was really neat to see them involved in trying to figure out what they should teach these kids and how they should, how their individual groups should link up together to make it all make sense. So we're going to advance the slide to the fourth example. And this is actually a current teacher now, and this is a project he's doing now. After I gave a similar presentation to my faculty, he wants his class to create a web quest on the Revolutionary War in Boston. And his target audience is a grammar school across the street from us, is the Cathedral Grammar School. And that's going to be a real group of students are going to experience the web quest that the high school students create. So they're going to, you know, hopefully get really involved with trying to figure out what they should teach these kids and what they should select and how they should manage that. The web quest itself, by the way, is a great example of social media, which I didn't list here, but WebQuest is pretty common. It's well known. It's been around for about 10 years. So we're going to advance the slide. So what are the common denominators here among these four examples? We see students collaborating with other students within class or and or outside of class. So that would be the engagement piece. Students are also creating something. They're creating a product for a real-world audience to experience. There's your construction. They're also learning how to be active citizens, especially in those first two examples where they were engaging with real-world issues, global warming, human rights, you know, the rights of the child. Advance the slide. And the I thought about this because this essay was written back in 95, I think, but it's still very relevant. In fact, it's almost more relevant now because you have all this in this web 2.0, so to speak, all these new avenues for publication which invite engagement and construction. For example, YouTube, podcasts, blogs, wikis, and a lot of the other presentations in the conference this these 2 days. I noticed there are a few about podcasts, blogs, and wikis. So, you know, we're all talking about the same stuff. And to me, it's become much easier to use these things. You know, back when I was teaching this stuff in the college 10 years ago, we were having to actually code HTML, you know, from scratch, and there wasn't too many editors around, so, you know, to actually publish our work on the web was difficult. The blogs now make it so easy, you don't have to know anything hardly. So Howard Rheingold, who's we'll hear more about soon, he calls these media participatory media. And if we advance the slide, we'll see more about this. You just think about how comfortable the kids are with this stuff. You know, they carry these iPods around. They're very familiar with the interface. They're also into the social software, MySpace and Facebook. My son is 17 now, and he says that he Facebooks his friends. So Facebook's become a verb like Google. There's also blogs, vlogs, and wikis. Vlogs being the video blogs, and then social bookmarking at a site like Delicious. And I actually included a link to my Delicious account in the supplemental links on the MassQ website, so that you can kind of see what that's about if you haven't checked it out. And the social bookmarking is a very, very powerful way of organizing knowledge now. So you should definitely check that out and try a search at Delicious for a topic and see what comes up and have that experience. So I have a few comics here for a comic interlude. This first one shows a family sitting around a table, eating dinner, and the father saying, "Well, yes, we could read your blog, or you could just tell us about your school day," which is just hilarious, I think. It suggests that the kids are really into this and talk about their day, and they write about it in their blogs all the time. Advance the slide to the next one. We see the Foxtrot comic where Peter's talking to his teacher, and the teacher's saying, "About your paragraph on Thomas Edison. It's a word-for-word copy of what's on Wikipedia. I expect you to do original work." Peter says, "Who's to say I didn't write the Wikipedia entry myself?" Save the loopholes for law school, son. Tell you what, I'll settle for a B+. And this is interesting because, well, it certainly could be Peter's entry. Who's to say it's not? And, well, actually, if the teacher knew about Wikipedia, he could look at the history tab and kind of see who's been involved in the writing. So that's one way that he can verify that. But the point is that anybody can edit Wiki and add an entry or edit it. Advance the slide to the next comic. Shows Adam at home asking his son to get off the computer and go outside. It's a beautiful day. Click, 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 click. Not for long. The barometric pressure is falling fast and showers are moving in. So again, I just think this is great because aren't we always telling our kids to go outside when it's nice? And here the kid's so comfortable with it, he just kind of probably pops on weather.com and quickly finds out, well, actually, it's going to rain soon, so I shouldn't go outside. Dad, I should stay right here on the computer, goofing off. Advance the slide. All these comics suggest that students are digital natives, which is a phrase I've been coming across a lot lately, and which suggests that we're the digital immigrants. And that would be me, because I didn't grow up with this stuff. I grew up with AM, FM radio, and learned how to type on a manual typewriter back in the 70s, late 70s. Then I owned my own electric typewriter in the 80s, and then eventually bought an Apple II in the late 80s, and bought a Macintosh in the 90s, and so on and so forth. So this fellow, Mark Prensky, suggests that our students have changed radically, he says. Today's students are no longer the people our educational system was designed to teach. Which is kind of an interesting thing to think about, that our students have evolved beyond the system itself. And I think that's a pretty powerful statement. So we'll advance the slide and see what else he says. He says, "It is now clear that as a result of this ubiquitous environment and the sheer volume of their interaction with it, today's students think and process information fundamentally differently from their predecessors. These differences go far further and deeper than most educators suspect or realize." He's saying that their brains are different. They're wired differently. They function differently. And of course this makes sense. You know, their brains have kind of been brought up with this different technology in their face all the time. And I just think it's interesting to think about that, as that they think differently than we do. So it's interesting, but it's also scary. Well, geez, you know, if they think differently than me, then how do I know how to teach them? There's this fellow, Howard Rheingold, I mentioned before, and he also uses this phrase, digital natives, and I wanted to point this out. And now you'll notice that there's this funny-looking guy in the front, and that's his avatar in Second Life, and there's a picture of him in the background there. And if I told you to advance the slide, I can't remember. But he delivered a lecture in Second Life, which I'll be talking about a little more toward the end of the presentation. And this is what he said in his presentation called The Pedagogy of Civic Participation. So advance the slide now. This is a long one, but it's worth it. constructivist theories of education that exhort teachers to guide active learning to hands-on experimentation are not new ideas, and neither is the notion that digital media can be used to help encourage this kind of learning. What is new is a population of digital natives who have learned how to learn new kinds of software before they started high school, who carry mobile phones, media players, game devices, and laptop computers, and know how to use them, and for whom the internet is not a transformative new technology, but a feature of their lives that has always been there like running water and electricity. This population is both self-guided and in need of guidance. Although a willingness to learn new media by point-and-click exploration might come naturally to today's student cohort, there's nothing innate about knowing how to apply their skills to the processes of democracy. I just thought it was striking that this phrase, digital natives, came up in two different places to talk about the same phenomenon of students who are being kind of completely and totally comfortable. They're you know, kind of raised in it, so they're native to it. And for them, it's like running water. So advance the slide. Now, Mark Prensky, in a second article, you know, actually talks about how the brains are different. And this is what he says. Some have surmised that teenagers use different parts of their brain and think in different ways than adults when at the computer. We now know that it goes even further. Their brains are almost certainly physiologically different. But these differences, most observers agree, are less a matter of kind than a difference of degree. For example, as a result of repeated experiences, particular brain areas are larger and more highly developed, and the others are less so. And again, it kind of makes sense. You know, if they're sitting there, you know, working a three-dimensional kind of virtual reality video game thing, that those centers of the brain that kind of focus on spatial orientation and their hand-eye coordination when it comes to, you know, shooting whoever or running over whoever or whatever they do in these kinds of games, that's going to kind of overemphasize those parts of the brain. They're going to be more robust over and above those parts that maybe are advanced when they read and write a book or a story. So advance the slide. All of this suggests that there are new literacies. And you'll hear this a lot, this literacy, that literacy. This notion of new literacy suggests that we need to expand the definition of literacy, which, you know, means to read and to write and to be able to function with reading and writing. Electronic environments place additional demands on and require different abilities of users. So, you know, they need to be literate in different ways. So now we can think of literacy as a moving target, as one scholar put it. I'm going to advance the slide. Here's another Foxtrot comic. It's kind of this notion of literacy. This is one of my favorites. So this is, you know, the little chat lingo that they have. You are too cool, dude. She says, "What are you doing? I'm chatting with Marcus. Geez, learn how to write properly. I mean, that's embarrassing." He says, "The U should be capitalized? Duh, it starts the sentence." So it's nice that she realizes that the beginning of a sentence should be capitalized, yes. But it's just hilarious that they would kind of applying the old medium of literacy to the new medium. So we're going to advance the slide. So I came across a number of different types of literacies, and I'm going to talk about four different ones briefly. Critical literacy, media literacy, participatory media literacy, and then electricity, which kind of circumvents the whole literacy thing. And I just wanted to point out that when I tried to look this up on Wikipedia, and it wasn't there, I thought, well, geez, I need to learn how to do this and create my own entry. So I started the entry on electricity in Wikipedia. And I think since then, the theorist who developed it has revised it a little bit. So advance the slide. So the first one, critical literacy, suggests that there's a need to evaluate websites now. We need to develop skills for determining bias and authority. And you've probably heard about this, and there's been some kind of initiative in your school to bring students to an awareness of, you know, the need to think about where these websites are coming from, who's publishing them, why are they publishing them, you know, what's their motivation, is it commercial, is it, you know, is there a hate group behind it or whatever. So this is very similar to, you know, another kind of literacy, which I'm not mentioning, information literacy, which comes out of library media science and library media specialists, which is the work I do. So advance the slide. Media literacy suggests that we need to focus on new media like video images and how to read these images. So how do we look at commercials? How do we look at the manipulations that are kind of put upon us by commercials and advertisements? And then also not only reading but to writing. So how do we write with these images? So now, you know, maybe there's digital cameras, digital video cameras out there. So how do we write with video? How do we compose video? And there's a great software, very cheap for Macintosh, called Comic Life. It's like $25. It comes with most new Macintoshes now. Put the website there for you. Now you can take digital photos and you drag them up into kind of templates of comic panes, and it's very simple to make a little comic book with Comic Life. So there again, here's a new kind of literacy. How do you write in a medium that combines text and images? Potentially very powerful medium. And, you know, just like television, comic books have been kind of dumbed down to mass market marketing. But the medium itself has incredible potential as a communication tool. It just hasn't been exploited. So, you know, what happens when we start to use this in our own institution? Please advance the slide. Then there's this notion of participatory media literacy, which comes out of the Howard Rheingold presentation. And this would be the media of participation, like blogs and social software like MySpace and Facebook and Wikis. These are the media that invite participation, that involve social networking. And a quote from Rheingold, who's quoting somebody else in his talk, says that this shifts the focus of literacy training from individual expression onto community involvement. The new literacies are almost all social skills, which have to do with collaboration and networking. So now we have a literacy involving how do we work in groups, how do we motivate people, how do we network, this kind of thing. And how do we use the technology to do that work? Advance the slide. And then there's this notion of electricity, which is a neologism that tries to describe all the skills necessary to exploit the full communicative potential of new media. And this is the professor I studied with and did my dissertation under develops this term, electricity. And he suggests this analogy that electricity is to digital media what literacy is to print media. And I like the word because it draws attention to the need for a whole new term that avoids the etymological connection to literacy. So we're trying to, you know, describe something new and we're using old terminology. So here's a new term which kind of incorporates electricity, or electricity kind of trying to pack a lot into one word. And I think it's very effective for that. So we're going to advance the slide. So what does this mean to us, the teacher? So this is suggesting that we need to teach to the student, to the digitally native student. So that's going to be different because they're different. Their brains are different, as Prensky was suggesting. Their experience is different, and their facility with technology is different. So this means that we're going to have to recognize and respond to these radical changes in information and communication technologies. You know, 3 years ago, there was no such thing as social bookmarking. You know, wikis and blogs have been around, but they've really taken off in the last couple of years. And you know, you just, when you start to read Time and Business Week articles about these things, then you know, you start to kind of say, "Whoa, you know, something's happening here." It's hard to miss it. And this also suggests that we should begin to use the new media for construction engagement and civic participation. If not for our own selves, then to get our students to start doing that. And what better way for us to do it than to invite our students to do it and say that we can learn along with you. Advance the slide, please. So this is Howard Rheingold on civic education, part of that talk he gave in Second Life. And I think this really taps what's possible. I think we have an opportunity today to make use of the natural enthusiasm of today's young digital natives for cultural production as well as consumption to help them learn to use the new production and distribution tools now available to them as a way to develop a public voice about issues they care about. So here he's suggesting that this media will allow them to engage in civic participation, and that we can begin to involve civic education when we use the technology. Let's get them talking about the things, the issues they care about, and they could organize, and they can go to work and become participants in our democracy, which is what we need a little bit more of, wouldn't you say? Advance the slide. To continue that quote, learning to use participatory media to learn and speak and organize about issues might well be the most important citizenship skill that digital natives need to learn if they are going to maintain or revive democratic governance. And I can't think of a better way or a stronger way of putting it there, of the reason why they need to learn this stuff. Now, this is stuff that none of you may, you know, be familiar with or even interested in knowing about. But you know, in this context, when you think about how Rheingold's putting it here, it makes sense that this is powerful, and you know, maybe we should start to learn this stuff so we can teach our students about it too. The most important citizenship skill. I was like, wow, that's very powerfully put, I think. Please advance the slide. So this suggests that there are changing roles for teachers. And what we have to recognize is that students know more about some of these new literacies than most adults. So that now what we do then is orchestrate learning opportunities between and among students who know these new literacies. And one quote suggests that in a student-centered social learning environment, this knowledge can be exchanged, ironically, in a classroom where the teacher may not know either of these skills as well as the students. So, unfortunately, in this situation, we have to kind of become humble as teachers and recognize that we're not going to know everything. But it's actually a real good opportunity to put our students in the role of teachers. Like, okay, so you know about this one. So what? So how do we do it? You tell us. You teach me, because I can't know everything. And it's just, I think it puts the pressure off of us, because there's no way for everybody to know everything. There's just too much to know. So some people will be experts in some things, and some will be experts in others. This suggests that our role as teachers is to get them hooked up and let's share the knowledge. Let's share the wealth. Advance the slide. Here's a quote from a great book called Understanding by Design, published by the AASCD Press. And it suggests that how we should put ourselves into the situation of being comfortable. Schools should require teachers to do action research so that they constantly feel what it is like to learn, to be reminded that real learning is always frightening, frustrating, and able to cause self-doubt regardless of age or talent. If the job and schedule make us think of ourselves as only teachers instead of also as model learners, we miss vital opportunities to make education more honest, invigorating, and self-correcting for everyone, adult and child. And I love this, because it says, hey, you know, we can model our learning, and they could watch us learning, and learn how to learn from watching us learn. So it's okay not to know something. In fact, it could be just right, the perfect teachable moment. So let's advance the slide. I lost my place there, so let me catch up. Here we go. So next slide. Now this is from a report from the Federation of American Scientists that just came out a couple weeks ago, and I had it posted on the supplemental materials also. And again, this is this particular report focused on harnessing the power of video games for learning, and it's saying that, you know, we as educators, we should begin to do this. So this quote's saying that, again, on the changing role of teacher, says, effective use of games and other new technologies is likely to be limited unless educational institutions are willing to consider significant changes in pedagogy and content and rethink the role of teachers and other educational professionals. So it's really, again, the transformative power of technology. This is suggesting that we should be transforming what we're doing, completely changing what we do as school, completely changing it. Advance the slide. Now I'm going to introduce Second Life as an educational space, and then that'll be the end of my presentation. Second Life is an online virtual world, a participatory social network, another catchphrase for you there. And this is what I was involved with when I heard the Howard Rheingold lecture back in mid-October. So it's much like a three-dimensional video game interface, but you also can chat with the people that you meet, and you could also build things in this world. And actually, the world is all self-created by participants. And one article that's quoted in my reference section that came out in eSchools News recently suggests that with its popularity, it's just like 1 million users now, it was only natural that educators would take notice of the phenomenon and begin exploring the possibilities of turning it into an educational tool. I'm actually part of a couple of email discussion lists that are like real life educators and Second Life, and there's a lot of research going on with universities and, you know, anthropologists and psychologists and sociologists. They're all looking at this thing. Economists. There are businesses moving in there. There's millions of real American dollars being exchanged in this thing. So it's its own little free market economy. It's quite remarkable. So I invite you to check it out. SecondLife.com. Advance the slide. Just to point out how much it's been in the news, I got involved October 5th, and that's when I started to tune into this. And it turned out that October issue of Wired Magazine had an article, a whole spread about it. And then there was an article in USA Today about colleges involved in Second Life. There was an article in New York Times about the economics of it, virtual world but real money. There was another one in New York Times just in general about the world itself. And then this one I just quoted from eSchool News saying that Second Life develops an educational following, just published not even a week ago. So it's been getting quite a lot of attention in the last month. Advance the slide. So what I've done here is to just capture a few pictures of this to give you a feel for what it's like. This one is at the Howard Rheingold lecture. There's a place called the New Media Campus in the Second Life. So you can see the avatars sitting in the stands, and you can see Howard's picture up there, and there's a little like a video screen almost there. And this is before the lecture, so people are gathering, and you can see the chairs where he's going to sit and talk from. So we're going to advance the slide. This is a picture of me. I'm Aberyst Brautigan in World, and I'm sitting by this fireplace, and it's actually quite beautiful, these trees and the snow and all this. Kind of peaceful, kind of relaxing to sit there in this virtual world by the fire there. So I'm going to advance the slide. This is a picture of the map. Kind of gives you some sense of what it looks like. This is a close-up. When you zoom right down on the map, it looks a lot like the kind of satellite photos of the world. And you can see here where there's like a little river, and the little green dots are where the people are at the present moment. And there's some islands and houses and whatnot. And you could also see some of the interface. There's the buttons the blue buttons down at the bottom. There's a place to type in your chats and whatnot. So I'm going to advance the slide again. This is a picture of me in the sixth floor of Parvenu Towers, which is on an island called Info Island, which is where all the librarians hang out. And so this is a library, and I'm part of the librarians group, and I've created a little area called Electricity. So you can click this little information button, the floating eye there. You can get websites on the computer terminal. And I'm working on creating this book here, with the selected works of the professor of mine, Greg Ulmer, who theorizes electricity. So this will be a place where you can come if you're interested in learning more about electricity. Advance the slide. This is kind of a neat sculpture, virtual sculpture, that's outside of the Parvenu Towers. And when you're there, this blue ball is actually spinning. And it looks quite striking. It's quite beautiful. I'm going to advance the slide. So Mark Prensky suggests that we should just do it. If digital immigrant educators really want to reach the digital natives, that is, all of our students, we will have to change. It's high time to stop our grousing, and as the Nike motto of the digital native generation says, just do it. And I include this because I have to admit, I've been guilty of grousing about how my students can't read and they can't write and what are we going to do with them. And at the same time, I've struggled because I read about kind of evolution and evolutionary psychology, and I think, you know, 40,000 years ago, our brains evolved, and they're much like they are now. And I don't think they're stupider than we are. I think their brains work just as efficiently, and they're surviving in their own way in the environment and age that they're growing up in. So if we believe that, if we recognize that they are just as smart as we are, but they might not be able to write and read as well as we can, but they can do these other things well. And so the idea is here, let's use some of that socio-media to transform the way we do education. And let's just do it. So that's all I've got. I have a couple slides of references with links, citations, a lot of links there for you. And then the last slide is my contact information. So if you have any questions, please feel free to email me, because I'm not there to actually answer the questions, but hopefully somebody will actually listen to this and, you know, get something out of it. And I'm so sorry I couldn't be there. I was really excited about giving this presentation and putting it together, but at least this is one way it might get out there to the world. So thank you for listening, if you were listening, and I hope you found something here of use to you. Take care. Goodbye.